Ladies and gentlemen, it's a real privilege to welcome back to the Salier Report Rob Kirby, who is the proprietor of Kirby Analytics. Comes in from Toronto, and he joined us in March for a really outstanding conversation about the Exchange Stabilization Fund. And when we finished, I said, Rob, we're really going to have to do one on interest rate swaps. And so he's very kindly returned, and he's prepared a wonderful piece called Understanding Derivatives. We're going to put it up on the website for subscribers and link to it from your subscriber resources in the Salier Report commentary for the Salier Report. And I strongly recommend you follow along. It's got some great charts and information in there. But that way you can listen, you can digest. We have in our subscriber base, people are extremely financially sophisticated, and others who are very intelligent but not that interested in financial stuff. So I'm going to have Rob walk us through the basics on what is a derivative. But I think it'll help you if you can access the Understanding Derivatives. And if you want to understand the management manipulation of our world, it's really very helpful to understand what's been going on in derivatives. And nobody has sort of dived in and pulled it out like Rob has over the last 10 years. And part of it is because he had a very significant career in the financial institutions trading some of these vehicles. So he's this is somebody who really has very deep knowledge of the topic, and we're very lucky to get him. So, Rob Kirby, welcome to the Salier Report.
Oh, it's just a pleasure to be back speaking with you again.
Okay, so derivatives 101. What is a derivative?
Okay, the word derivative is a very, very big umbrella. And underneath that umbrella, there are a lot of different instruments. To give you a for instance, underneath the derivative umbrella, we would find things called futures. We would find things called options. We would find, for instance, futures on commodities. Could be commodities in the agricultural sector, like a corn future or a pork belly future. We would find futures and options on currencies. So it could be a future on the U.S. dollar, a future on the euro, a future on the yen, and or options on all of the above. And it could be some more sophisticated products, which would be known as interest rate products, which could be the two specific interest rate products that we're gonna delve into on a deeper level today are a interest rate product called an FRA. Forward Rate Agreement or Future Rate Agreement. That particular interest rate product is a short-dated, it's classified as a swap, but it's a short-dated bet on what LIBOR will be at a date in the future. And the other interest rate product that we're going to discuss today is an interest rate swap. And what happens in an interest rate swap? It's an exchange of a fixed rate for floating rates between two counterparties. So that sort of gives you a bit of a broad swatch of what is under the umbrella of derivative. And when you look at the derivative spectrum, for instance, in the American context, there's a quarterly report that's published by the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, and they report publication called the Quarterly Derivatives Report the amount of outstanding derivatives in aggregate that are held by American banking institutions. And this data is published in arrears, three months in arrears. So the most recent data we have published by them would be the Q4, fourth quarter of 2016, end of December. And that report was just published at the very end of March this year. So, and in that table, it tells us that all American banking institutions in aggregate hold currently, or at the end of December, $220 trillion worth of derivatives. And that would be everything under the umbrella that I just spoke of. And then when you look at the breakdown of which of the derivatives under the umbrella make up the lion's share of the outstanding amount, you would find that somewhere between 75 and 80% of all the aggregate, so it's between 75 and 80% of the $220 trillion is in interest rate contracts. So this is why we're going to be focusing on the biggest component of the derivatives pie.
Before we go further, though, I want to stop and make sure we have two concepts on the table, or one concept and one definition. One of the reasons we use the term derivative, or I think of it very oversimplistically, is if you take a stock or a bond, it's a financial instrument in an underlying pool of assets, which are usually real. So if I own a share in a cow, you know, the cow's real, but I have a, you know, if I make it an equity, then I have a financial instrument and something that's real. But a derivative is a financial instrument in a pool of financial instruments or another financial instrument. So
no, actually, Catherine, the derivative is the share. The underlying is the cow. The share
right.
is the derivative.
Right, but when we say a derivative, it's usually a financial instrument in another financial instrument. In other words, it derives its value from a financial instrument. The underlying
yes.
is financial.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
So it's a
derivative
it's usually
of a derivative of sorry, you go ahead.
So it's usually one step back. So people are used to thinking in terms of stocks or bonds, which is one step. A derivative is two steps. So if I have a future in a pork belly, then I've got an interest in a index on something that's real. So I'm two steps
that's
back.
Right.
Exactly. So it's kind of oversimplistic, but okay, but the other thing is, most people are used to, say, looking at stocks, many of which trade on an exchange, but very few of outstanding derivatives trade on an exchange, particularly interest rate swaps. So you have an expression called OTC, over-the-counter. So if you could just explain what OTC or over-the-counter means and what it means that, you know, the banking regulators say that they provide data on this, but there's not the same data collection and reporting that you'll see on stocks or bonds.
Yes. Well, you make a very good point that there are exchange traded derivatives where the product is uniform across the spectrum. For instance,
right.
if you buy a euro dollar future, all Eurodollar futures are 3 months in duration, and they settle on the third Wednesday of December, March, June, and September. And so these are uniform contracts that trade with specific dates known to everybody. Whereas if you do an FRA or if you do an interest rate swap, each individual swap is tailor-made and tailor-constructed for the two people entering the agreement. And so they are not all of a uniform date. There are some that are, but typically they're custom, and they typically trade on a spot basis. So an FRA traded today would be for value 2 days forward, or would be for
right.
or it could be for value a week forward. It could be value a month forward on the third Wednesday, or the second Tuesday, or the so they're custom every time you do a trade, and they don't trade on arbitrary or preset dates. So, and because they don't trade on arbitrary or preset dates on an exchange, they're referred to as OTC or over-the-counter. And what over-the-counter probably means more than anything is lack of regulatory oversight,
right,
and custom, like custom dates, tailor-made for custom custom dates for the players that are entering into the contracts. So is that a very good
That's very good. It's, you know, I think of it kind of like the Wild West. It's hard to get the information you need to understand it as a pool of financial assets. It's hard to get sort of an actuarial beat on it because, you know, it's kind of out there, the Wild West, and there's not the same kind of data and transparency and regularity about all of it.
Yes.
I wanted to just mention, I would be perpetually grateful to you because when I first saw your name at through the GATA group, I was trying to explain to folks how they were engineering the slow burn. And, you know, there was this big debate. Various people would say, oh, it's all going to crash. And I'd say, no, it's not going to crash. And so a discussion unfolded. This is in the 90s about derivatives and how the derivatives book was exploding. And I didn't understand anything about derivatives at the time other than I'd sort of watched them operate when I was on the board in Sallie Mae. And there's a funny story there I can tell you. But you know, I started to read your work, and you made it very clear, look, we don't have a derivatives problem. We have an interest rate swap engineering, which is, you know, not only making this game go, but it's driving interest rates down. And you were the one who kept banging the drum and saying, stop talking about derivatives, you know, the whole umbrella. Let's talk about interest rate swaps. Because if you look at the total outstanding, you know, that's if there's one dominant picture to the derivative story, it's interest rate swaps and what it's done to drive interest rates down. Is that fair to say?
Sure thing. And it's not just the interest rate swaps that have been used. It's also the short-dated product, the FRAs that have been used. The FRAs are what they use to entice banks, make banks captive to buy literally any amount of U.S. short-dated U.S. government debt, as in T-bills. And to make short-dated interest rates or short-date interest rates, it's one thing for the Fed to declare that they've got the discount window open and they will lend money to banks on an overnight basis at 25 basis points. But to actually get people to buy three-month government paper or a T-bill at 30 basis points or 10 basis points, that requires a little bit of secret sauce or mustard. And the mustard that gets applied in a very generous way is an arm of the government conducts FRA trades with banks at rates that compels them to buy U.S. government debt to lock in a risk-free profit. So it doesn't really matter how low rates get if you put the carrot out in front of the bank, where the bank, if they're going to do the business with you, all they need to do is buy a treasury bill at a rate. They will do this if they can. They will be compelled to do this if they can do it and make money risk-free.
Right. So you can float a near infinite amount of treasury securities as long as you take away their interest rate risk and you make sure the money doesn't cycle into the economy in the way that kicks off inflation. So if you keep the proceeds headed into the insiders in certain ways, you can debase the currency, you know, in extraordinary amounts and grow debt in extraordinary amounts.
Sure, and what else this does is it provides a remarkable avenue for the powers that be or regulators to recapitalize institutions on a selective basis if they are deemed to be in the, you know, winners or in the national interest.
Right.
And the other thing that might actually be a good thing to put in the listeners' minds is when we started off by saying that there was $222 trillion in aggregate by all American banking institutions at the end of December of 2016, in saying that 98 or 99% of this aggregate $222 trillion is held by five banks.
Right.
And I call them the Magnificent Five. And those institutions are Citibank, JP Morgan, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, and Morgan Stanley. And these are the chosen counterparties of the US government to conduct this derivatives trade with, that controls the interest rate playing field.
Now, before we go deeply into what we think is going on with those five banks, let me just step back. Derivatives really developed and grew during the 90s. I mean, it really came with the ability of the computation systems to handle this kind of complexity and developing the mechanisms.
They were actually pioneered, believe it or not.
Right.
They were largely pioneered right here in Toronto in the 1980s. And
right.
They were pioneered here in the 1980s because of quirkiness in the Canadian Bank Act. Canada, as a country, prior to 1981, we had six banks in this country. And we changed our Bank Act in 1981, and we allowed foreign competition to come into our banking sector in Canada. Excuse me. And so Canada went from having six banks, and overnight we had 87 banks, and with a lot of them being American banks. And what happened, the banking fraternity in Canada had a lot of power, and they got the government to put restrictions on the amount of capital that foreign banking institutions were allowed to have in Canada. And when you restrict the amount of capital that a bank has, you really curtail the manner in which they conduct normal treasury operations in a bank. And I'd like the listeners to understand that at the heart of banks is the treasury. It's literally the lifeblood of a bank, because it's where the bank raises money, and it's where the bank funds all of the obligations that the bank has. It's all done from the treasury, and the treasury is probably and arguably the most important profit center in a banking institution. But when you have restrictions as to how much capital you have, traditional banking treasury operations, and when I say that, I'm going to talk about typically a typical bank treasury operation would be to lend money, like a long-dated money, and fund it short-term and earn a spread. But that requires capital, and it chews up balance sheet. And so what banking institutions needed to do was develop a way they could synthetically trade the yield curve without impacting the balance sheet. So what they did, using derivatives, they were able to move the speculative part of playing the yield curve, they were able to move it off balance sheet and get around the capital restrictions that they had here in Canada. And the three pioneers, the three banks that were at the head of the list in developing these interest rate derivatives here in Toronto were Citibank, Chase Manhattan, and Chemical Bank. And they were the three leaders in instituting, developing and instituting certainly the FRAs, and they were huge players in developing the interest rate swaps as well.
Right. And, you know, it's funny, my impression in the U.S. was a lot of the players. I was on the board of Sallie Mae, and I'll never forget 1994, the CFO gave a presentation on the interest rate swaps they were doing. And coming out of the, you know, sort of the SNL debacle, the way the Feds recapitalized Citibank was it was the same thing. They floated federal credit arbitrage profits that were enormous and just recapitalized the bank out of basically risk-free trades between the long end of Treasury and short. It was quite remarkable to watch. But anyway, so during that period, Sallie Mae was trading through Treasuries because of what was going, the shenanigans going on in the Treasury market. Anyway, they made a presentation. We had five vice chairmen of banks on the board, and they made a presentation on how the interest rate swaps work. And I realized we had seven vice chairmen, and nobody on the board understood derivatives.
Well,
and I thought, ooh.
And that's very, very common, that
right.
People at the heads of institutions have very little understanding of A, what these trades are and how these trades are consummated and what the implications are and how they can be used. An analogy I like to make with people when they say, well, are derivatives good or are derivatives bad? And I like to answer it sometimes by asking a question in return. Is a chainsaw good or is a chainsaw bad?
So bad.
If a chainsaw
right.
is used to cut down and make to create lumber, it's very good. But if the chainsaw is used to do Texas Chainsaw Massacres, not so good.
Right. Well, one of the reasons I was absolutely convinced that they were, you know, the banks were taking most of these positions as agent for the federal government is I think every bank chairman would have known backwards and forwards and by heart how they worked. If that was a risk position for which they were responsible, I think there would have been a lot more knowledge.
I would suggest to you that somewhere in the time frame of 1988 to 1990, somewhere in that window, and I know that because I was a broker of these instruments, and I was also at the same time I was a broker of government bonds, and I noticed that there were players in the U.S. Specifically, I can reference Chase Manhattan Bank would play the derivatives in a let's just say in a way that nobody else was playing. And when I say this, they would come into the market and in an interest rate swap between 3 and 10 years of duration in the interbank market, typically what happens, because these instruments trade on a spread relative to treasuries expressed in basis points, the players typically exchange an underlying amount of government debt, and we would call them on-the-run government bonds. And to be a little bit clearer about that, if you were doing a $25 million 5-year interest rate swap transaction, when you're doing the trade, the one side of the trade would buy $25 million worth of U.S. government bonds from the other side of the trade. And so one side supplies the bonds and the other side buys the bonds. And I noticed that in that time frame, Chase Manhattan would come into the market and they would offer interest rate swaps at a specific interest rate, and they would state that they will not supply the bonds to the buyer. And this would entice a spread playing counterparty to go into the cash bond market to purchase these bonds. So
right.
In effect, but because Chase Manhattan would come in the market and take punts, literal naked risk on interest rates for 5 years. The spread playing counterparty would then be forced into the cash market to buy bonds. And this, what this does effectively is it creates phantom settlement demand for U.S. government bonds.
Right.
And in this manner, if instead of Chase Manhattan being the one side of this trade, as I just explained, if you substituted an institution like the U.S. Treasury or the Exchange Stabilization Fund, which is a part of the U.S. Treasury, if you substitute them in for Chase Manhattan in the example I just mentioned, you could effectively get banks to buy any amount of five-year government debt. You know, it would be of your choosing. Right. So you could literally make banks be captive buyers for trillions of dollars in five-year U.S. government bonds.
Right. So let's go back to 1980. Because in 1980, an American citizen could get an 8% return on their bank CD. And so you could have $100,000 at a bank in a CD and get $8,000 a year. It's very, you know, it was a good time to be alive. Now you're getting zero because interest rates have come down, down, down. And they've come down, down, down since 1980. But particularly in the post-9/11 world, we've seen just interest rate drops that we didn't believe possible.
But can we just back up for a second? Because
sure.
in my world and the way I view what you just said, when you say interest rates have come down, 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 my response is interest rates have been forced down, down, down.
Right.
You see, interest rates. Just bear in mind that when you assign a zero rate to capital. Just remember that human beings are capital too.
Right.
And nobody that I'm aware of works for free.
Right.
And you see, forcing interest rates to zero creates issues. It creates negative issues for humanity. Because
right.
what it does, effectively, it trivializes labor.
There was a study McKinsey did on the capital markets recently. And I forget the exact number, but they basically estimated that government was getting several trillion dollars a year of subsidy from low interest rates, and that was coming from people's pension funds and their retirement
savings.
Oh,
exactly.
Right. So what you're talking about is engineering a $2 trillion of people's labor for free into governments. It's one of the greatest taxation schemes in the history of the world.
Yeah, it is fraud on steroids that you can't imagine.
Right. Right. Oh, I can't imagine. I absolutely can't imagine.
For most people, it's difficult to comprehend.
Right.
And what it is representative of is currency debasement in the extreme. And
right.
Why most people don't complain about it is because currency debasement in the extreme causes things like the value of real estate to go up in nominal terms.
Right.
And it causes stock prices to go up in nominal terms. And if you happen to be a property owner or a homeowner, or if you happen to own stocks in your 401k, and when you see that the value of these things are going up in nominal terms, it creates a false sense, or I would have it, a false sense that you're getting rich and that you're very smart.
Right.
So this is how they pander and play to people's emotions, by debasing the currency. And, you know, debasing currency is dishonest commerce.
Right.
And most people, if you ask them straight up, if they're fans or advocates of dishonest commerce, most people, I think, would say to you, no, I'm not in favor of dishonest commerce.
Right, but it's phenomenal, Rob, how they've engineered this in a way that people don't see it and can't see it. Because you've basically had, you know, they make it look like a market phenomena. You know, my interest rate's going down because that's how markets are working.
It's not only that, Catherine. You're right. They like to disguise it, but they also will not allow people in the mainstream, like the analysts, the people that wear the suits that work for the banks on Wall Street. They will not allow them to report it, because you know reporting things like this makes you as popular as Edward Snowden. You are persona non grata, and it's a right. great way to end a career.
Exactly. So, well, let me just point one thing out. So let's take the average.
And you know what thing, I just wanted to just make the point. You uh-huh. know a thing or two about that as a person, a truth teller. I mean, this is really your history.
Right. So the American family of four, you know, instead of getting 8% on their CDs for the last 20 years, they're getting 0% now. So they're out an enormous, and if you look at their pension fund, you know, their pension fund is getting zero. And so, you know, between their bank CD and their pension fund and their 401k and their IRA, they're out an enormous amount of money, and it's just explained, oh, well, it's markets. But if you look at the other part of their balance sheet, they're assuming the liability for the derivatives on the government's balance sheet, whether, you know, whether reported or not. So their liability for the derivatives that have been used to engineer all this money out of their pocket, you know, instead of getting the yield, they're getting the liability. So their assets are going down instead of up, and they're assuming responsibility for the derivatives that are used to engineer this. So it's a double whammy.
Sure it is, and the other point I'd like to make, if there are people listening who say, you know, as long as my housing prices are going, or, you know, the value of my house is going up, and my stocks are going up, I don't really care whether they're manipulating rates to zero, and you know, and I borrow money, and I like rates at zero. But
right.
to anybody out there who has a pension, to anybody out there who has insurance, and to anybody who understands how vital insurance, an ongoing and healthy insurance industry is to conducting commerce, if you think about it quickly, if there was no such thing as insurance, like how would you be able to drive a car? How would you
right.
be able to how would you be able to protect your house from fire? How would you be able to protect and if the pension industry, where would your monthly check come from if the pension plan that you contribute to goes to zero? You see, and when you artificially put interest rates at zero, just remember that pension funds and the insurance industry are mandated to hold a certain amount of their assets in fixed income. And when their fixed income assets don't earn what they've modeled them to earn, and I can tell you that most pensions and most insurance companies model into their portfolios that their fixed income portion of their portfolio will earn them 5% or higher.
Right.
And in a zero interest rate environment with, you know, 10-year bonds yielding 2 and with 5-year bonds yielding 1 or less, these guys are not making their nut.
Right.
And what it means is the viability of pension funds and insurance companies going forward is highly in doubt.
Well, I would say there's something even worse going on, and I'll tell you what it is. You're engineering one set of players to have a zero cost of capital and other set of players to have a much higher cost of capital. And you're literally taking money from the productive and giving it to the, you know, call them slime bags. You know, but you're creating a dynamic where you're pulling from the productive and you're giving to the unproductive.
Well, exactly.
Because you've got a whole world of insider who are getting more and more free money and more and more free money and more and more free money, and they're getting, you know, they're getting more corrupt, they're getting more wasteful.
Catherine, you're hitting the nail right on the head, because right. imposing zero interest rates and assigning a zero rate of interest to capital has many, many negative consequences. The other thing, and which you just summarized, but you could put an umbrella over that, is zero rates of interest encourage, let's just say, negative or
right.
Misallocation of capital, because right. when there's zero cost to money, every harebrained scheme on the planet will be tried by somebody, because they can right. do it at basically at zero cost. So, and this is how you end up with a whole lot of white elephants, and white right. elephants usually aren't in the best interests, for humanity going forward on a productive basis.
Well, let's talk about the ESF, and then I'll go to the point I was just about to make. So, you and I both believe that this is this huge derivatives book, and let me step back. $220 trillion is notational value; it's not present value. Is that correct?
It's called a notional value, because what an interest rate swap is, by definition, it's a synthetic loan, where you
right.
synthetically borrowed money, but the principal amount has not changed hands. So right. what you're doing is you're effectively betting on the value of fixed versus floating rates on an agreed upon amount.
Right.
So if we do a derivative on a 5-year derivative, we're effectively betting on what a fixed 5-year rate that we agree on today. What's the difference between that and the amount of interest that 5 years, let's put it this way, and let's use round numbers too to make it very, very simple. If we take $25 million and we assume a 10% interest rate fixed for 5 years, you would have payments of what would that be? 10% of 25 would be 2.5. So you're talking on a fixed rate basis, there would be $2.5 million worth of interest payments made annually at 10% on $25 million. So then if we said, well, instead of $2.5 million a year, so you'd have, you know, 5 times $2.5 million at 10%, which would give you $12.5 million in aggregate in mm-hmm. interest rate payments. And then if we said, what would happen if we compared the $12.5 million guaranteed on the fixed rate, if we invested the $25 million in 3-month increments at the prevailing 3-month rate as we moved along, would that add up to more or less than $12.5 million? So the difference between what $25 million would earn invested at 3 months for 5 years versus what we know would be paid at a fixed rate. So that's right. what you're actually betting on. But the $25 million doesn't, like, nobody lends you actually $25 million
right.
in a 5-year right. interest rate swap. So we say that the notional amount that we're betting on is $25 million. And then we're gonna see who wins between who the winner would be between the floating rate accumulation versus the fixed rate accumulation of interest. And that's what it really is. It's a bet. It's a bet on fixed versus floating.
Floating, right. But I think that having a notational value makes it, for people who are not used to dealing in notational values, it makes it look bigger than it really is.
Sure. But I mean, yeah. when you're playing in really, really big numbers, a very, very small deviation if you look at somebody, for instance, you take a player like Citibank. And their book currently, their derivatives book currently, I believe, is around $51 trillion in notional, most of it being interest rate contracts and a lot of it being interest rate swaps. You know, if they have a book of a swap book of call it say 40 maybe 40 trillion of the 51 trillion in notional, and if they have a 1% deviation in the value of that 40 trillion, you know, you're talking about probably more capital than the bank has.
Right.
So 1% or 0.5% of an extremely large number, if things go not the way you hope they go, could effectively wipe out a bank's capital. And I would have it.
Unless their dealing is agent for the ESF.
Well, no. My comeback to you would be, assuming, of course, they actually have accounting. And you see, there is a law in the United States which grants officialdom the power to give a waiver to an institution if it's deemed to be in the interests of national security. Companies can be granted a waiver where they don't have to report their true economic situation, which effectively means if the government or if a designate of the government, because not anyone in government can issue this waiver, but let's just say if Morgan Stanley was technically insolvent and bankrupt in 2008, which I believe they were, and if they were granted a waiver saying that they don't have to report their true financial condition, they could keep two sets of books and they could say that they're fine even and everything's good even though they are bankrupt.
Right.
So this is a law that's been on the books in America since 1934. And this law was put on the books at the very same time when the Exchange Stabilization Fund, this secretive arm of the U.S. Treasury, was created. And there's no doubt in my mind that these waivers have been in play, and specifically I believe that they've been in play with the financial institutions through the financial crisis of 2007-2008.
Right.
So, and from that standpoint, you can start asking yourself questions. Who gets to make the choice? Who gets to make the choice, for instance, that Bear Stearns fails or Lehman Brothers fails and Morgan Stanley is allowed to continue? So we have people that have enormous power, and they're making decisions on who the winners and losers are.
Well, it was very interesting when all that rolled out, because I knew that they couldn't let AIG go down, and I knew they couldn't let Morgan Stanley go down, but they could afford to let Lehman and Bear Stearns go down. Because you're looking, so the question is, who is operationally, who is the government dependent on operationally for both primary dealers, ESF, and a variety of different servicing and security. So Morgan Stanley and AIG were deeply involved in the operational infrastructure of the government, and AIG in particular. If you look at the federal budget, we are in essence financing two civilizations out of one budget and keeping one of those civilizations secret. And AIG was deeply involved in the liability management for the secret one, and there was no way you could let those files just go wherever they were going to go. If you let it, you couldn't let AIG go down.
Well, of course you couldn't. Well, the implications of letting AIG go down in the 2008 time frame would have created a chain reaction, because AIG had to be kept whole and had to be kept or had to be bailed out, because AIG had guaranteed a lot of bad bets that the likes of Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan and Citibank had made. You see, AIG guaranteed guaranteed trades that these other institutions made, that had AIG gone down and the insurance not honored, then Goldman Sachs would have been dragged down too. So
right.
the decision was made to bail AIG out and make them whole so AIG could make good on their payments to the other banks. I mean, and that's literally what it was.
Well, that was part of it, but it was bigger and badder than that.
Oh, yeah. No, but I mean, things were lined up like dominoes. And
right.
had AIG been allowed to go down, all the dominoes were going to topple. So, but this comes back to the point I was making a little bit earlier. You've got people making decisions on who lives and who dies, and you know, and who's allowed to continue, and who gets sent to the glue factory. And I mean, that's all in well, I guess, to keep the financial system operational. Unless, of course, you work for one of the institutions that they've chosen to, you know, allow to perish.
So here's the way I would say it: to finance these two civilizations out of one, and keep one secret, we've built a highly leveraged edifice of debt and derivatives. And now that debt and derivatives have basically locked us into a future because nobody can afford for it to collapse. And, for example, if you look at who built that whole infrastructure, because, you know, when we bubbled the economy, 90s and 2000, so 1994, we bubbled the economy with debt and derivatives. We suck an enormous amount of capital out for that second civilization. You know, my estimate is $50 trillion. If you look at the team that engineered it, I would say that the Goldman Sachs team rising through the fixed income division, where they oversaw both debt and derivatives and precious metals all in the same division, was basically Lloyd Blankfein and Gary Cohen. It's not an accident that after engineering the financial coup d'etat and being intimately familiar with the leveraged debt and derivative book, Goldman being a primary dealer and also big positions in the derivative, we're sending Gary Cohen in to be National Economic Advisor because one of the things they want to make sure, whatever the new administration does, they want to make sure that he doesn't hiccup the derivatives book.
Yeah. And it also is, speaks to the, Catherine, it speaks to the notion, look who has controlled the U.S. Treasury over the last 20
years. Right. Right.
And you see, it's my view, and this is very consistent, and I would suggest in lockstep with what you're saying. The real prize for the deep state. Yes, the U.S. military is an important muscle to put things into play around the world. But the real, in my view, the real prize is control of the U.S. Treasury. And when you control the U.S. Treasury, you control the Exchange Stabilization Fund. And I would have it that the Exchange Stabilization Fund, with the Exchange Stabilization Fund holds dark, what I call dark money, and it's money
right.
that's not even really acknowledged to exist. And I suspect and believe that the amount of dark money that's housed by the Exchange Stabilization Fund very likely it amounts to tens of trillions of dollars.
That's very interesting because one of the things I will tell you, it's theoretically possible, that these positions could be held on a different part of the federal government balance sheet other than the ESF. But I don't believe it. I believe it's in the ESF. But in theory, you know, it could be, since we don't have access to the real financials, it could, in theory, be another part of the federal balance sheet. So I do want to point that out.
Yeah. And one thing we do know, for anybody who might be poo-pooing this, we do know that the financials the government gives us in so many instances
are complete bunk. You know, it's really funny because I was the FHA commissioner, and I brought in what I believe to be the top accounting firm to do all sorts of stuff. But, you know, after it was all said and done, when I saw the lies coming out of Treasury Department of Justice, you know, the HUD, all the different infrastructures in the mortgage operations, Fannie, Freddie, and that accounting firm. That was the day when I saw the extent of the lies and the extent of the financial fraud, and proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that they were all in on it and they all knew, you know, at least at the top. That's when I said, you know something? All these financial statements for Fannie, Freddie, the Treasury, ESF, I don't believe any of them.
Well, that's just it.
You know, yeah, I don't believe a word.
And in your case, Catherine, you single-handedly discovered this. I believe the number was $50 to $60 trillion worth of fraud in your department alone.
No, the $50 trillion is across what I've discovered.
I meant $50 to $60 billion. I think is what you discovered in your department.
Depends on how you count it. What I discovered was, what I believe is, the amount of outstanding mortgages, mortgage insurance in force at the FHA at the time I was there, was three times or more what was on the books. And that's, you know, that's $1 trillion or more of just collateral fraud.
And let's just say that there were people that were signing off on that on a yearly basis stating and effectively giving it their blessing and stating that all was well. Well,
right.
All wasn't well. And
right.
I'm only making that point just to speak to people who might be saying, how can you make such outrageous statements that there could be that much dark money housed in an institution? And, you know, and from there what is it that the Pentagon alone has said that they can't account for?
Last year alone, this is 1 year, in 2015, so we just got the reports on 2015, the Pentagon was missing $6.5 trillion in undocumentable adjustments, which is more than 10 times their entire budget. Now, with securities fraud, you can do that. And don't think these derivatives don't help with that securities fraud.
Oh, absolutely,
I mean,
they do.
Derivatives turbocharge what the federal government could do in terms of collateral and securities fraud. Absolutely turbocharged. And the proof of the pudding is, you know, we had a housing market collapse in 2006, rolling into the bailouts in 2009. We had $27 trillion in bailouts when $8 trillion would have paid off all the mortgages in the country. Now,
there you go.
That is a signal of, yeah. In the first year, I think it was 2010, there was a report from Australia that on their U.S. mortgage securities, you know, they'd experienced a 50% default rate. Well, I'm sorry, that's fraud. That is collateral fraud. That's not, you know, subprime mortgages. Ho, ho, ho. And I think, you know, your theory as to one of the reasons they took over Freddie and Fannie was, you know, I think Freddie and Fannie, because why wouldn't you take it back private? You know, they're using that as a collateral fraud and derivatives toxic waste dump. Has to be.
I completely believe that to be the case.
Right.
Just understand, folks, the numbers of that we spoke of earlier in aggregate held by American banking institutions being $222 trillion at the end of December 2016. Those numbers don't include whatever might be being housed in Fannie and Freddie.
The holding, right, exactly.
And these institutions, let's just say, would both be natural repositories for this kind of nuclear waste,
right.
to be, you know, to have an awful lot of it housed in there. So when we speak about the size of the derivatives market, Nobody really knows just how big the derivatives market really is, because I don't believe that.
Keep going.
I was just going to say, like, we can grapple and get a handle on what the banks have, but what's being held behind the curtain
right.
You know, with the likes of Fannie and Freddie, we just don't know.
So here's what I keep trying to communicate, and I struggle with how to do it. Since 1980, interest rates have been going down, 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 and we've been issuing more and more debt. So think of it every year as a civilization, we spend 100, but we only earn 80. And we keep growing the debt, and the derivatives help us do it, and we keep playing this game, and we've now reached, you know, we're reaching the ceilings of the debt growth model. And I'm not saying we're reaching the ceilings of the derivative growth model, but if we're reaching the ceiling of the debt growth model, we're probably approaching the ceiling of the derivative growth model. Now, here's the thing. If you've got to pay back that accumulated deficit by reversing out of the debt growth model and living within your means, I mean, so we've been spending 100 but only earning 80. If we go to only spending 80, that still doesn't pay back, you know, the accumulated deficit. So we, in theory, to get this back in balance, would have to go back to spending 60. So,
or we could adopt the European model and have negative interest rates,
which would finish wiping out the middle class.
Well, absolutely, that would be the final assault on capital itself.
Right.
But I mean, just when you stop and think about that, the European system of governance and the way it's financed. I mean, you know, there's a big reason why interest rates were forced to zero, because the biggest debtor on the planet, America, can't afford to pay market rates of interest.
Right.
Because if America was forced to pay market rates of interest, they would have to default on their debt.
Right.
Because they don't have the income to support market rates of interest payments.
Right.
So, you know, this also speaks to the notion that people say, well, what happens when rates go up? Rates will never be allowed to go up.
Right.
In any material way.
Right.
And
it's
if rates
nuclear.
Do go up, it means, if rates do go up, I would offer and argue that would imply that we have had a debt default and we've had a reset, and which would mean that effectively, the dollar has been displaced as the world's reserve currency. So that to me is what the implications of rates going up really mean.
Well, I think they're going to bump it a little. I mean, I think the Fed's going to take it up another 50 to 75 basis points. So,
but I mean, you know, isn't it interesting that when the last time when they raised rates 25 basis points at the short end of the curve, the 10-year bond was at 2.5. Well,
right.
Today the 10-year bond, after you know, raising rates a couple of times, the 10-year bond today is at I believe it's at 2.20 or 2.18.
Right.
So
right.
The long end of the curve. What we're seeing is the yield curve.
You're just flattening the yield curve. Yeah, you're just flattening the yield curve.
And flattening of the yield curve is usually a harbinger for very difficult times coming up. And typically it...
Well, I don't know about you, but as far as I'm concerned, it's been difficult time for quite a while. From the moment 9/11 happened, we were in difficult times.
Yes. And
right.
And quite frankly, we were in difficult times before 9/11.
Right. 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 Okay, so let me go back and talk a little bit about what's happening in the District of Columbia right now, because one of the things we see is we see a Congress, you know, it looks like the Keystone Cops on healthcare or tax, any issue, everybody's going around in circles. You have a president who's doing so many U-turns, it looks like he's going around in circles, but nobody in Washington can face or come to grips with this, because we have an entire ecosystem of players who are in denial. So let me go back to my concept. We've been financing two civilizations out of one budget and keeping a civilization secret. I liken this to, you know, the stories of the guys who have like two families in two different towns. They've got one job, they're financing two families, and the two families don't know the other exists. And, you know, they're trying to keep it all together, and finally, you know, they have a heart attack and everybody discovers what's been going on for the last 20 or 30 years. Well, we've got a similar kind of situation where Congress can't, you know, they can't balance the books because they're not allowed to be transparent about what's really going on. And so they're kind of going around in circles, and we have an entire society in a state of unbelievably deep denial. But one of the things we know is, you know, the derivatives and debt positions rule. And so the question is, how do you get out of this? How do you help the entire ecosystem start to face reality and see what's really going on?
And the answer to that question is, frankly, I don't believe there is an easy way out of this. I don't believe the people that have put us in the predicament that we're in are ever going to come clean, or ever going to give up, or admit
right.
or admit what they've done. And right. it seems to me it's no wonder to me that I know that what's been done is not sustainable long term or forever.
Right. Right.
And I sense that we're very likely getting very close to the end of this road that we've been on. And what scares the daylights out of me is that there's history with financial elites that when their games with money and their games with debt, when they come to an end in history, they seem to like to take people to war, and
right.
and then they blame the war on the financial catastrophe that they created.
So let me talk about a little bit about the war that's being engineered right now. What you're looking at is the finishing of the Wesley Clark 7 countries in 5 year plan plus Korea, which is basically trying to bring into the central banking system all the players. Because if you can bring everybody into the system and shift to a digital global currency and delete cash, then you've got a way of harvesting the system much deeper in a way that will keep the game going.
I hear what you're saying, and to my way of thinking, there are players in the world that will not allow this and will not conform to it. And my worry is that we will have nuclear war before that mandate is ever going to be fulfilled. That's what
right.
bothers me the most.
Well, but here's the thing. What I want to point out is if you're the player who doesn't want to see it happen, you have a reason to take it to that extreme to stop it. In other words, you're basically fighting for the right to be human as opposed to be slave.
Exactly.
Right. So
exactly.
So this is live free or die kind of moment, and that means we could see a nuclear war.
And that's what concerns me. And you know, the people that are behind, the people who control these financial levers that we're speaking of, these are the globalists. These globalist people have written white papers. They're well on record. Like, the whole globalist movement at its core is eugenics based. These people believe that the planet is overpopulated dramatically. Instead of the 7+ billion people that are on the planet today, if they had their way, there would only be 500 million of us.
Right.
And this is why you see such globalist personalities, or at least in my view, why you see such globalist personalities as Bill Gates being huge investors in companies like Monsanto, the progenitor of all of our GMO food. And GMO food is known in studies to be a sterilant, and they know that when they've fed rats GMO corn exclusively, I think it's like within 90 days they have a completely sterile rat by feeding it GMO food. And yet we're told, for some reason, we're told that GMO food is good for us, and there's no concerns. All I'm saying is that the spread of this GMO is very much in speaking to the plans of globalists. Eugenics based,
right.
They want fewer of us, and what better way to do it than controlling birth rates? So,
well, and I also think they're very afraid of how you keep control. There was one thing I wanted to mention, because to get to where we've gotten with this debt growth model, one of the things they've had to do is they've had to shut off the fire alarm or the smoke alarm, which is the price of gold. And so part of the derivatives bulge is creating enormous amounts of paper gold. And, you know,
absolutely.
If you think you have fun trying to figure out how many derivatives there really are, sit down. I've tried a couple times to figure out what the outstanding inventory of gold on the planet is, and I just give up. But one thing I know, there's a huge amount of paper gold that is just paper. And, now the big...
And
right.
And the issue also extends, and maybe even more so, to silver, because silver is consumed, whereas gold tends to be stockpiled. Silver is consumed and used in many industrial processes in very minute amounts, but is not easily replaced with anything else. And when you look at the COMEX exchange in New York, and you look at the open interest in the silver paper silver futures contracts, and you can see because the open interest on silver is something like 128,000 contracts. And each contract of silver is for 5,000 ounces of silver, which means that it's over a billion ounces of silver. Like, let's just make this clear to people. There's nowhere on the planet where you can go and get a billion ounces of silver. It doesn't exist anywhere in a stockpile. But yet people have sold over a billion ounces of silver on one exchange. The COMEX exchange, which the volumes that are traded on COMEX pale in comparison to what's traded on the LBMA, London Bullion Market.
You know, there's a reason that the big silver ETF is serviced by JP Morgan Chase.
Well, of course, and you know, in any case, the amount of paper that gets sold relative to the amount of physical metal there is available in the world. The amount of physical metal available pales in comparison with the amount of paper that's sold. So you basically have people that don't own or possess any silver, but yet they can sell in paper form unlimited amounts, and that also is not a sustainable model going forward, because there are people who see through this fraud, who demand the physical good. And when the physical good can't be delivered, this is when you have things called defaults, and this is when you can have very, very disruptive and dislocations in markets. So this is something that, in my view, is going to come, and it's a matter of when, not a matter of...
So two things I wanted to bring up, two more things. One is... I had a conversation with a wonderful ally the other day who said, you know, when you talk about the $11.5 trillion of undocumentable adjustments to the government, you sound like all you care about is money. You don't care about people. And I said, well, you know, when I talk to you about the $11.5 trillion, the reason I am is I care about people, because if a group of people can get together and steal that much money, then they can run everything. You know, no matter what our governance systems are, and they can control you financially, no matter what our government systems are, and it can do terrible harm to people if you look at what's going on. You know, to me, if there's any one problem, it's that. And so it's because I care about people. And he said, well, you have to explain it to people in terms of, you know, things that impact people. And so how much of, you know, how much is 11.5 trillion, you know, meaning people have to go out and get student debt instead of have, you know, have reasonably cost college and stuff. You need to talk about it in those terms. But one of the things I know is that you've always raised your hand and tried to explain about derivatives because you see, you know, these windfall taxations being applied to, you know, the general population through the derivatives book. And to you, it's a people issue. It's, you know, it's compromising freedom. It's compromising people's financial wherewithal. You know, if that much in a tax was just formally announced and legislated and everybody had to hand over, you know, 25 to 50% of their net worth in a formal taxation, they'd be up in arms, but somehow doing it through the back door invisibly, you know, they don't even notice. They know something's terribly wrong.
I agree with all you've said, but maybe even stated a little even simpler than that is dishonest commerce does not make for good good friendly relations with the people that you're interacting with.
Right.
And you know, if there's one thing that defines our world today, we have a bunch of countries who don't trust each other and are at loggerheads with each other, and I would have it that this is all the result of dishonest commerce.
Yep.
And I mean, you know, if you even think back to biblical times, you know, when according to the Bible, when is the only time that Jesus ever lost his temper? It was,
right.
You know, he flipped the tables on the money changers because,
right.
You know, they were engaged in dishonest commerce.
Right.
And honest weights and measures are a good foundation for, let's just say, sanguine interaction amongst humanity.
Right, so they've destroyed the pricing function and it's destroyed markets and now nobody trusts each other.
Exactly.
Right.
And what we try to do is illuminate or, you know, shed some light on what's been done. And, you know, this should bother everybody because, you know what, this has all been done in our name. And
right. I don't know if you saw Jamie Dimon explain that, Jamie Dimon, the chairman of J.P. Morgan Chase, explain on his annual letter that something was wrong with America. But J.P. Morgan Chase endeavored to treat their clients as you would want your mother to be treated.
Yeah.
When I saw it, I almost fell off my chair. I said, Jamie Dimon must have a memory wipe every night.
Well, you know what? You know what, Catherine? It's incredulous what comes out of the mouths of some of these captains of industry and people in the financial system.
Well, it's a complete inability at this point to take responsibility or even see what the responsible position would be. I mean, they just, you know, talk about lost. The one other thing I wanted to mention to you, because you wrote a great article when I was up in Canada about Community Wizard, the idea of a software tool that would allow everybody to see the government money for their neighborhood. You know, because
exactly.
I think part of the problem is whether it's derivatives or the federal budget, it's all so big. We need to see it contiguous to the world where we, you know, we walk around and have an impact. And I don't know if you saw this, but the guy who left Microsoft, the CEO, Steve Ballmer, I think is how you pronounce his name. He's just
Ballmer,
announced.
I believe, yeah.
Yeah, he's just announced a huge effort to take all government money and spending and make it accessible through a new website called USA Facts.
Well, here, listen.
Here. So my attitude is let the fireworks begin, because ultimately, you know, the real solution to everything you and I have been talking about is if 3,100 count, you know, if every neighborhood or every place can start to affect and get the money turned productive place by place, that's how we're going to start to make real progress on this.
I agree with you 100%. It's not like we don't have the tools and we don't have the ability to do things in a in a responsible manner. It's just having the will to actually do it.
Well, and I think the other thing is the productive people are mighty depressed, because if you my father was a surgeon, and one of the things you learn is the body in trauma will shut off blood to the toes and the fingers and protect the blood supply for the heart and the lungs and the brain. And we've got an economy that is constantly pulling the blood from the heart and the lungs and the brain to the toes and the fingers. And, you know, if you're the heart, lungs, and brain, you're tired of the extremities pulling all the blood, and you're tired of being asked to produce more just so it can be pulled down to the extremities. So, you know, I think what has to happen is we need to figure out a way to make sure the blood is flowing to the productive. And that gets back to this question of allocation of capital. And it's one of the many reasons why I think the derivative story is so very important for everybody to understand.
Yeah, and it, you know what? And also, just so people also can wrap their head around where derivatives came from in the very beginning anyway.
Right.
Because it points out how things that are meant with good intentions end up going awry and not being used in the manner in which they were intended. Derivatives came from the agri sector in the very beginning.
And
the reason they were developed was farmers were having used to shoulder a lot of risk between the time they planted their seed and the time they would harvest their crops, because like farmers knew, it goes back into the 30s and the 40s, when farmers would plant their seed, they'd know what they had to pay for their seed, and to get it planted. But the thing that they never knew was what the crop was going to be worth in the fall when it was harvested.
Right, and commodities prices can be very volatile. So
yes,
so I would hate to see. Derivatives do so much good. Go ahead.
I was just going to say the very first derivatives were in the agri sector, you know, for wheat and for corn, and what it allowed farmers to do after they planted their seed, they could sell some percentage of their harvest forward at a price known today, so that they could somewhat insulate themselves from, you know, like. You know, if it was a bumper crop year and the price of corn or the price of wheat fell through the floor due to a bumper crop, you know, farmers might not be able to recover the amount of money that they paid to actually plant the crop. And so the futures market in the agricultural commodities came about as a means of transferring risk away from farmers and into financial markets, so they financialize the agri commodities, and so that's where they got their start, and from there they sort of flourished through the other segments of the economy, whether it be, you know, financial futures or precious metals futures. But I mean, it all came out of the, you know, a rather honorable calling to help farmers, and look what's happened.
Right. So if we're gonna turn the situation around, we don't want to throw. You know, we still want to be able to use the chainsaw to cut down trees.
Yes.
We don't want to lose the. Yeah, chainsaws are not in and of themselves bad. I agree, because I like to see. You know, I can think of historically wonderful applications for derivatives in hedging investment portfolios. So I'm a big believer in hedging in all sorts of circumstances. Okay, well, Rob, before we close, any other points you want to make about derivatives, or any way you want to summarize this information for the audience? This has really been wonderful. I have to tell you, over the last 10 years, you've done incredible things to to make this issue understandable for people, and I really appreciate it.
Well, I can only hope that anybody who's listened has gained a little bit more understanding than they previously had, and be aware of your surroundings, and if anything, I'd like people to understand that the current path that we're on is not sustainable, which is why I'm an advocate of people holding a certain percentage of their investable right. assets in physical precious metal.
Right.
Probably not a bad idea to have some storable food. To me, these are just prudent things to do in this day and age.
Now, you represent BMG Bullion.
I do indeed.
People do want to talk to you about that, because I've always believed BMG is a very, very high quality custodian relation. So if you want a custodian for the worst case, it's sort of the one of the creme de la creme of custodian quality. So they can talk to you about that, but they can also talk to you about Kirby Analytics. If you could just describe your website and your newsletter.
You can catch me on the web at kirbyanalytics.com, and I would just mention that there is an enormous repository of articles on the site, and because I've probably written 850 or 900 articles over the last, I don't know, dozen years or 13 years, and there's a lot of stuff that's that I might have written 10 years ago that might be more relevant
right.
today than when it was. So anyway, there you go. And I add new material as I feel that uh-huh. commentary is appropriate. So there you go.
Now let me just ask you a quick. I'm going to ask you to engage in wild speculation. How much do you think derivatives have had to do with the administrative U-turns into war that we've seen in the last 2 weeks, 3 weeks in the United States?
I think they probably had an enormous impact on the thinking of Donald Trump. There was a time right after Trump was declared the winner in the election that he made a visit to the White House, and he seemed to me at a press conference after spending an hour and a half with President Obama, where he seemed to me to be absolutely visibly shaken. And my guess, he used some words to reference the sort of knowledge that he had gained or information he had gained, and I think the words he used was high-flying assets. And those were the words, I believe, that came out of Trump's mouth, and which would tend to make me think that what he was probably shocked to learn was probably something of a financial nature.
Mm-hmm.
And he may have been told right up front about the situation or the enormity of what the ESF is involved in.
Right.
And this is something that, in my view, might explain his stunned look. And it's interesting because there was a great article that was put out by one of the British tabloids. They seem to cover this quite a bit, referencing this meeting back in the fall. And they had body language experts give a written critique on Trump's gestures and the look on his face at this particular media scrum, and it's very telling what they had to say. They said he was shocked, and he had learned. They just said he has clearly learned something that he didn't know, and it's got him extremely concerned. So, It might have been Donald's introduction to the world of derivatives and just what the ESF has been up to. I wouldn't be surprised at all if that's exactly what happened.
Well, I think it's not just the ESF, the derivative position, but where all that money is going and how much more money is expected. I mean, part of the problem, I think, is the system is maintaining an overhead that's secret, and they feel they have to continue to maintain it, but they can't tell anybody what it is.
Exactly. No, this is deep, dark secret. This is national security. This is more secretive, in my view, the stuff that we're talking about here, I think, is probably a deeper secret than, you know, nuclear secrets.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because this is the very essence of, you know, of our financial system. And, knowledge and transparency in this area could bring the whole house of cards down. And I think at the end of the day, very likely.
Or give us the transparency we need to really solve things.
Yeah. Anyway, to me, the size and scope of this issue is too big to be tinkered with. That's my view of it. Too big.
Right. Well, you know me, I'm always the optimist. I think that the wealth destruction that has come from maintaining it is reaching a tipping point where it's greater than in other words, you've reached a negative return. You've got a negative return on investment, and it's gonna keep getting worse until you change it. So the question is, how do you change it?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, well, Rob Kirby, you're a prince among men, so I can't thank you enough for everything you've done for us over these years. Keep going, and we'd love to get you back on the Salieri Report. I know there's going to be a ton of questions, so get ready for them to come your way, okay?
Looking forward to it.
Have a great day. Bye.
You too. Be good.